Welcome to this Forthright Radio for September 2nd, 2020. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today. Returning for the full hour is Tom Hartman. The latest in his Hidden History series has just been released by Barrett Kohler Publishing. The Hidden History of Monopolies: How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. In addition to his daily three-hour radio program, he somehow finds the time and energy to write the Hidden History series, and he has been generous enough to be our guest on Forthright Radio each time one is published. You can find the past shows on the forthright.media archives. Here's what Ralph Nader writes in the foreword to The Hidden History of Monopolies. Quote, "This is the most important dynamic book, small as it is, on the cancers of monopoly by giant corporations written in our generation." He goes on, "Because he is by far the most erudite longtime national radio talk show host, he has had an uncanny sense of retrieving critical segments of American history ignored by historians regarding the suspicion and caution our forebears had about this artificial entity called the large corporation as it became more immune and more privileged than real human beings." He goes on from there, but we'll just let Tom speak, and you can hear for yourself why Nader has such high appreciation of the man. Tom, welcome to Forthright Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Joy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tom, at the beginning of your book, The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream, just out from Barrett Kohler Publishers, you raise the age-old fundamental question, is the economy here to serve the majority of the people, or are the majority of the people here to serve the economy and those few who own the largest part of it? Good question. You begin answering it by going back to before the American Revolution, to one of the causes of the revolution. What was happening?
Just to back up just a big, huge way, in December of 1601, Queen Elizabeth signed the charter and brought into existence the first of the modern world's relatively modern corporations, the British East India Company. And fast forward 170 years later to 1770, the British and U.S. economy, or what wasn't U.S., colonial economy at the time, fell into what was somewhere between a severe recession and a Great Depression. And the East India Company, which was principally owned, their stock was principally owned by the British royalty and nobility and members of Parliament, turned to the British Parliament and said, "We need help. We're out of cash and we're freaked out here." And the way that they paid tax on tea, which was a very, very large part of their business at that time, was that when they received the tea into inventory in the UK, that's when they paid the tax on it. So they had millions of pounds of tea in the United Kingdom on which they had already paid taxes. And so what the British government did is said, "We're going to give you a rebate on all these taxes. We're going to give you a massive tax cut. And on top of that, we will give you back the money." And that allowed the East India Company to sell that tea into the British colonies in America at dramatically lower prices than they had been selling, subsidized by the lack of tax and also by that tax rebate. And the colonists, tea houses back in that day in the 1770s were as common as, well, actually more common than Starbucks. Almost every city block had a tea house on it. They were the meeting places. They had bars in the evening for men, but basically the meeting places where people got together and did everything from socializing to business were tea houses and little restaurants that served tea and stuff. And most of them actually bought their tea from smugglers, American and Dutch smugglers who were bringing it in from various parts of the world. And the British had been trying to put an end to that practice for some time. This tax cut gave the East India Company the chance to just wipe out the smugglers because the smugglers couldn't sell tea as cheap as the East India Company could. So the colonists, who were small business owners in many cases, I mean, a lot of this got hatched originally at Sam Adams Tavern, a small business, said, "No, you know, we do not want this giant Walmart-like operation to come into our community and wipe out our local tea shops. We're just not going to allow it to happen." And so they marched out in the fall of 1773 to the British harbor and poured over $1 million of over $1 million worth of tea into the 353 chests, as I recall, into the Boston Harbor, which then caused the British government to retaliate with the Boston Ports Act, saying, until you repay this company that $1 million, no products can be offloaded in Boston, which led directly to the Boston Massacre and the shot heard around the world in the American Revolution. So basically, America's revolution was birthed in a protest against the Walmartization of tea shops.
It's a reminder that very, very far back in the United, what became the United States history, is direct action, violent against property, demonstrations, whatever you want to call it. And nowadays, the property class is shocked, that there's looting going on or property destruction by those who feel that social injustice is happening. That's an aside. If you wish to comment on it, please do.
America was birthed in protest. It's one of the reasons why the First Amendment says that the government shall not pass a law restricting the citizens' ability to peaceably assemble and petition their government for redress of grievances, in other words, to protest. So it's one of our most important First Amendment rights. It's the one by which we enforce democracy, essentially. It's the one by which we hold our leaders accountable. And typically, as a country slides from democracy into oligarchy or tyranny, that's one of the very first rights that gets taken away.
Well, we'll see how that plays out. I'm glad you brought that up, though, because you also point out that the founders, after the revolution, as they're deciding how to set up the government, they were actually talking about different forms of monopoly, everything from the economic to the intellectual, and that there was a very lively discussion going on. Share with our listeners about that.
Sure. This was, you're talking about patents, trademarks, and copyrights?
Well, yes. And also the quote from Thomas Jefferson's letter, he wanted anti-monopoly language in the Bill of Rights.
That's
but
right.
Go on.
Well, yeah. Okay, so let's start there. In the Christmas season of 1787, in the summer of 1787, Jefferson's protege, James Madison, they were very close friends. Madison was about 20 years younger than Jefferson. Madison had kind of shepherded the Constitutional Convention. He kept all the notes, which he kept secret until after everybody had died, and largely moderated it, although he wasn't the official moderator of the convention. And so they were all done by, as I recall, September. And Madison then, in the fall, sent a copy of this brand new constitution to Thomas Jefferson and said, "What do you think, boss?" Jefferson at the time was the U.S. envoy to France, so he was living in Paris. And Jefferson read it and sends him back a letter in late December, early January, in which he says, "You know, I really like the division of government into three parts, and I like the checks and balances, and I like this, and I like that." And then he says, "And now I will tell you what I do not like." And he says, "You know, there's," and he starts out by saying, "There needs to be a clear Bill of Rights that is unambiguous and says without any possible confusion that the right of free speech is to be held, the right of the press is to be held, the freedom from religion is to be held, that the right of due process," which is now the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments to the Constitution, "are held, the right to privacy." And he includes in that a ban on monopolies in commerce, which is monopolies, which was pretty impressive. And he not only sent that letter to Madison, after he had read the Constitution, he sent letters to a half a dozen other American statesmen who were involved in drafting the Constitution, arguing for his list of things that should be on the, in the Bill of Rights. And in every single case, that ban on monopolies was there. That was the one thing. And keep in mind, this, he had written the Declaration of Independence against not just the British government, but against the British East India Company, who really was the enforcer for the British government outside of the British Navy and Army. And that was the one part that never got passed. But what they did was, when they were drafting the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, they said, "For the advancement," I'm doing this from memory, so I might be paraphrasing a bit, but basically they said, "For the advancement of the useful arts and sciences," in other words, to promote invention and to promote commercial activity, "Congress may pass laws protecting copyrights, trademarks, and patents." Jefferson was opposed to that. He did not think that that form of monopoly, government-granted monopoly, should be in the Constitution either. And the reason why was he felt that, and he was an inventor. He had over 200 major inventions. Ben Franklin, his very close friend, was also an inventor. Franklin stove, bifocals, and 300 or 400 other things that he invented. Neither of them had ever filed a patent application. And Jefferson, when he was a late teenager, when he was studying law, worked one summer in a patent office. So he knew the process, right? He processed patent applications. So he was of the opinion that when you invent something, you are standing on somebody else's shoulders. You know, that Thomas Edison couldn't have invented the light bulb if somebody hadn't invented the wires to carry the electricity to the light bulb, or invented a generator to produce the electricity, or et cetera, et cetera. That every invention stands on the shoulders of something that precedes it. And the minute that you say you can no longer stand on somebody's shoulders, that's when you start slowing down innovation. And he was concerned that innovation was one of the things that would make this country vital and give us a vitality that was so important. He ultimately settled, as president, in fact, with 3 years. Congress passed a law saying that copyrights and patents lasted for 3 years. And he felt that that was a reasonable compromise. That was long enough for people to get some benefit from what they wrote that was copyrighted, or art that they did that was copyrighted, or from an invention that they patented. But he felt that more than 3 years wouldn't be such a great idea. Fast forward to America in the 1970s. Mickey Mouse is about to go out of trademark. Disney is freaked out because if the mouse goes into the public domain, anybody can draw the mouse. And so they started lobbying very aggressively. Sonny Bono was one of their people. And so we got the Sonny Bono copyright extension law. And, you know, we've had a whole series of these. The mouse runs out of trademark sometime this decade again. So I'm expecting that Disney will figure out another way to buy off politicians. It's, you know, we're pushing 100 years here. So things have certainly changed.
You make a distinction. You're not saying that all monopolies are bad. It occurs to me, we have not even defined what we mean by monopolies. Why don't you take a moment and do that?
Sure. The principal purpose of a monopoly is to eliminate competition. Competition is the thing that, in a free market economy, competition is the thing that keeps companies relatively honest and that keeps them on their toes and that keeps an economy vibrant and effective and active. And so the whole point of a monopoly is to stop competition. Now, there are some areas, some sectors of our economy where there actually isn't, it's physically not possible to have competition or inappropriate. We don't want competition among fire departments, for example. We just want to have a single fire department that has a monopoly on being the fire department and that is funded by our government. We don't want competing police departments. We want a single police department, or at least at a local level, and a single one at the state level, and a single one at the county level, that have singular responsibilities and that are paid for by us collectively. In the more commercial sphere, you have what are called natural monopolies. For example, here in my house, I've got electric lines coming into my house that provide me with the electricity I'm using to talk to you right now, Joy. And there's only one wire. So if I wanted to buy my electricity from a different utility, I don't have that option. I've got one water pipe coming into my house, and there's only one supplier. I've got one septic line leaving my house. There's only one company that processes septic. In most cases, in about half the cases in the United States, these are government-owned entities that are handling these natural monopolies, and they tend to produce better power at lower costs with greater reliability, and the same for water and septic. And about half of them are for-profit companies, and they tend to produce worse products with worse service and higher prices because they've got to pay dividends to stockholders and multimillion-dollar salaries to CEOs and things. But these natural monopolies are the logical place where you would expect government to operate, since they're the only accountability. I mean, if I don't like my power company, I can't fire them. I can't threaten them. I can't get rid of them. And whereas if my power company was the government, if the government owned the local power company, then they would have an elected official who is in charge of that power company or appointed by elected officials, and I would be able to bring political pressure to bear to make changes. But if it's a for-profit company and I show up with a picket sign or a protest sign, they'll just have me arrested. So these natural monopolies, you know, and this is a conversation we haven't had in the United States since the 1950s. These natural monopolies are places where I think, frankly, we should bar private enterprise from participating. Roads. There are some libertarians who argue that all roads should be toll roads. If somebody wants to go on the road, some billionaire should be able to make a buck off it. They also argue the fire department should be privatized. If you're going to have fire service, there should be a billionaire who can make a buck off it, et cetera. I disagree with that. I think that all of these natural monopolies that we have really are the province of government.
Let's back up a bit and talk about, again, how the monopolies arose. First of all, they're almost entirely corporations. And we have a wonderful show on KZYX called Corporations and Democracy that has been investigating corporations for decades now. But let's just do a refresher. The founders invested the power to incorporate and the control in the states. Talk about that process, please.
There are provisions for federal corporations, but they're really, really rare and they're really awkward. Amtrak is an example of a federal corporation. But generally speaking, business corporations have to be chartered in a state, in an individual state. And the corporate laws, the laws that govern corporate charters, the articles of incorporation and bylaws, the laws that regulate those have changed pretty dramatically. The largest changes happened in the 1890s, but over the last 200 years in the United States, they've changed quite substantially. And a lot of that change came about because of John Rockefeller and monopoly. In the 1880s and through the 1890s, John Rockefeller had perfected a very, very predatory form of business practice in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Americans don't realize it, but back then in Ohio and Pennsylvania were like Saudi Arabia. You know, there were oil wells everywhere. They're all largely dried up now. And then the oil went to Texas and Oklahoma, et cetera. But John Rockefeller had a number of these oil wells, and he wanted all of them. And so he cut deals with the railroads to give him better pricing and to raise prices or even slow down the service of delivering the oil from his competitors. He sabotaged them. He would undercut their prices. He was just a ruthless, vicious businessman. And then the final thing that he did, which is what pushed the state of Ohio over the top, was he would go to his competitors and say, listen, I'm going to put you out of business. I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this. And here's your alternative. Let me buy the stock of your company. Let me buy your company. I will pay you with stock in Standard Oil. So there will be a no money exchange hands. But you will get rich off this stock and we will get rich off your company becoming part of a much larger company. And one after another, his small competitors fell like flies. There were literally thousands of them at the beginning of this process. They were down to a few dozen by the time Ohio took action. And Rockefeller had locked up 90% of the oil. So then Ohio said to John Rockefeller, we're going to send you to jail. You know, you are violating our state antitrust laws, and you can't do that. And so Rockefeller reached out and said, what state is willing to change their rules to give me the ability to do what I'm doing? And a competition began between Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and Delaware. New Jersey won the competition, and all they had to do was just change their laws around corporate charters and make it easier for a corporation to do business with basically no oversight. And Delaware has the most permissive laws now, which is why half the companies on the New York Stock Exchange are Delaware corporations. But in the middle of that process, New Jersey, because Rockefeller had to run, he was on the verge of going to jail in Ohio. In the middle of that process, New Jersey got his business, which is where we got Standard Oil in New Jersey.
You call that charter mongering in your book.
Yeah, that's what that era was referred to as, the charter mongering era.
And you also note, Tom Hartman, that as of 2016, I'm not sure if it's Delaware or New Jersey and Delaware, had more than 1.3 million corporations chartered there. That's astounding. But it's pretty much just a paper deal. It's not like they're actually doing the business there, is it?
That's right. In Delaware, there are places with post office boxes, thousands of post office boxes, and those are the headquarters for thousands of corporations. There are also law firms that represent, in some cases, tens of thousands of corporations, and they become the official address of those corporations for things that have to do with incorporation.
It's kind of like the Cayman Islands of the East Coast or something.
Yeah, only it's corporate charters rather than banking, but yeah.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. What can you tell us about the Tillman Act of 1907 after other companies emulated what Rockefeller was doing?
Well, one of the ways that Rockefeller was able to exercise as much power as he could, first in Ohio and then later in New Jersey, and many other states as well, was by buying off politicians. And he was a major corporate donor back in the day. And this was reaching scandal proportions. The Gilded Age, the 1880s and early 1890s, until the Great Depression of 1897, that Gilded Age was marked by what we would call billionaires today. Rockefeller's wealth was certainly in the billions in today's dollars. And the American people were not happy with it. It was a time of growing inequality. Labor strikes were being crushed. People were being shot in the streets by goons hired by corporations and et cetera. And the government was not doing anything at all about this. So in the election of 1904, Teddy Roosevelt had been elected vice president in the election of 1900 under McKinley. And McKinley was assassinated in 1901, and Teddy became president. And so when he actually ran for president in 1904, he was a wealthy guy from New York, from a wealthy family, and with a lot of wealthy friends. And a lot of them helped out. They kicked in money for his presidential campaign. And his political opponents used that viciously against him, both in that campaign and in 1905. And so Teddy, kind of burned by this or stung by this, and also, you know, no real fan of monopolies and corporations either, Teddy did two things. Number one, he started investigating Standard Oil for antitrust violations, a process people think that he broke up Standard Oil. It was actually William Howard Taft, the president after him, who finished the job, just like Richard Nixon broke up AT&T, but Jimmy Carter was the one who finished the job. But anyway, he was investigating them, but he also argued in favor of legislation that would make it a felony for any corporation or any officer or agent of a corporation, which would include John Rockefeller, to give any money or any sort of material support to any candidate for federal office anywhere in the country. And that became law in 1907. It was referred to as the Tillman Act, and it stood until the Supreme Court struck it down in 1976 or 78.
William Harding comes into office in the early 1920s. At that time, the top tax rate was 91%. He managed to get it lowered to 25%. That led to the roaring 20s with one of the biggest bubbles in our history, and that resulted in what you call the Republican Great Depression. Then FDR comes in, and he tries to remediate this. We won't go into the New Deal and that sort of thing, but what I do want you to talk about is Franklin Roosevelt's warning that fascism would come to America in the form of corporations and vested capital. Could you expand on that, please?
Well, when FDR came into office, the nation was prostrate. We were just flat on our back. The week that he was inaugurated, the last banks failed. Virtually every bank in America had failed. The stock market had collapsed. It had been going on for 3 long years. And President Hoover had been doing basically nothing about it. His Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, had said, just liquidate everything and it'll just create space for new companies to come along and the economy will slowly recover. Don't worry, like magic, it'll go away. And it didn't go away for 3.5 years. And so FDR immediately put into place these massive programs to inject cash into the bottom of the economy, putting people to work, the WPA, the CCC, programs like that. And he started working on things like Social Security. And the billionaire class, as it were, what we would call billionaires today, the multimillionaire class back then, was very offended by this. Keep in mind, this was also the time that the Bolshevik Revolution and communism in Russia and the formation of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was only a decade old, or a decade and a half. And people were pretty freaked out about that because they had taken all the private property away from everybody and nationalized everything. All the fat cats ceased to be fat cats in Russia. And so the charge against him was essentially that he was a communist. And he just took them on. You know, he said these economic royalists say that we're trying to destroy the institutions of America. What they really complain about is that we seek to take away their power. And then he goes on to say that this kind of power is destructive to America, and it's our duty to overthrow this kind of power, this kind of concentrated corporate power. So that was the battle that he fought, and he fought it very successfully, and he beat back these giant corporations. And the result of that was that corporations and very, very wealthy people basically stopped engaging in politics from the mid-1930s right up until 1972. Although Lewis Powell came along and put an end to all that. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Let's move ahead. Okay, so we survived the Great Depression. We survived World War II. The GIs come back. The women have been working in industry. The GIs come back. And for white people in particular, it's a boom time in the economy. Talk about what life was like post-World War II, right up to Reagan, because what you have to say is really important for us to remember if we lived through it and learn about if we didn't, because the memory's fading fast and nobody in power wants us to know about this.
Yeah. Productivity is what a worker can produce. Right. If one worker can produce 20 widgets an hour and those sew 20 pairs of blue jeans an hour, then that's a certain measure of productivity. And as from the onset of the Industrial Revolution in the 1880s up until 1980, for 100 years, basically, as productivity increased, largely as a result of automation, so did workers' wages. So workers were able to produce 20% more stuff over the course of a decade. Their pay went up 20%. The company made more money. The workers made more money. Things were shared. And there were two things that really were pushing this. The first was that in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt had legalized unions through the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act. And the second was that the top tax rate was 91%. And so for CEOs and other fat cats, it was like, well, we leave the money in the business and pay the workers, because if I take it out, the government gets 91 cents out of every dollar after my first couple million dollars. And so CEOs, typically the maximum CEO pay was around 30 times the minimum worker pay, or the lowest paid worker pay, because anything more than that was just stupid. You started hitting that 90% tax bracket, or the 70, 80, 90, in that range. So those two things cause working people to suddenly become prosperous. My dad got a union job in 1956 when I was 5 years old. Before that, he had been, in fact, it must have been 57. I must have been six because I was in first grade. But the year before that, or the years before that, he had been selling vacuum cleaners and World Book Encyclopedias door to door. And we were living in this little one-bedroom house, a two-room house in Lansing. And we would go every other weekend to what we called it the cheese store, the surplus food place. And we get a 10-pound block of cheese and a 25-pound bag of macaroni and a 25-pound bag of powdered milk. And to this day, I hate powdered milk and macaroni and cheese. But he got this union job and boom, just completely changed our lives. And he bought a house in the suburbs. It was a modest house, but he bought a house in the suburbs. He was able to buy a new car every 2 years. He was able to take a 2-week vacation every year. Over the course of his life, he saved up enough money that when he retired after 40 years with a pension, he had a good retirement and his house was paid off and he was able to, he had a good life. And that all largely went away in the 1980s. When Reagan came into power, a third of America was unionized and the top tax rate was 74%. LBJ had dropped it down to 74% in 1967, but it was still above 50%. So these dynamics were all still in play. And Reagan first went after the unions because the unions were the principal funders of the Democratic Party, with his attack on PATCO right after he was elected, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, one of only three unions that had actually endorsed Reagan. And they had done so because he had told them that he would endorse their strike after the election to get new equipment for the air traffic system if they would support him. And so they did. And then he stabbed him in the back. And by 1990, 10 years later, we've gone from a third of America being unionized down to around 12 or 13% of America being unionized. Right now, it's 6% in the private sector. So the war on unions was underway. And at the same time, the tax rate got dropped down to 25%. Reagan dropped the top tax rate. And so CEOs could now take that extra money that was in the corporation that was the result of extra productivity and stuff it in their own pockets. So we saw CEO pay go from 30 to 1 to 100 to 1 and then 200 to 1 and 300 to 1. And in some industries, it's over 1,000 to 1. You got CEOs. The last CEO of United Healthcare took about $800 or $900 million. The guy before him, Dollar Bill McGuire, took over $1.6 billion in pay and compensation from United Healthcare. This is where your healthcare dollars go. And the guy before him had taken a mind-boggling amount of money. So that's what happened. You know, the workers got screwed and a new elite class arose as a result of Reaganism.
Conspiracy theories are ever more popular these days, but one that we have invested entire shows into is the very effective organizing, let's call it, after the Lewis Powell memo was sent to several thousand industry leaders. And in that, he laid out a long-term program of education and think tanks and control of the judiciary, that sort of thing. As I said, we've done whole programs on that, so we won't go into it now. However, less often talked about is the influence of Robert Bork during the Reagan administration. Now, as a reminder to listeners, Robert Bork had been the Solicitor General under Richard Nixon and the acting Attorney General who okayed the quote-unquote Saturday night massacre in Nixon's attempt to impede impeachment. All right, so we go ahead a decade, and Reagan appoints Bork to the federal circuit judgeship. Talk about what he does that's relevant to the monopoly issue.
Bork was a conservative ideologue. He was a student of Milton Friedman's at the Chicago School of Economics and became convinced, enamored of this idea back in the late 60s, early 70s, that our monopoly laws were antiquated, unnecessary, overly complex, and needed to be fixed. Now, he was being a Friedmanite, he was on the side of big business and the billionaire class and the giant corporations. He was never a friend of small or medium-sized businesses. And traditionally, companies were viewed as having multiple constituencies to whom they had responsibility and to whom they must answer. There was the constituency of the employees. There was the constituency of the stockholders. There was the constituency of the customers. There was the constituency of the community in which the company did business, or the state in which the company did business, if it was a very large company. There was the constituency, as it were, of how they affected the quality of life in their business practices and pollution practices and things like that. And Bork came along and said, all that stuff is nonsense. We don't have to worry about that. The purpose of a business or the definition of a monopoly is very, very simple. It's something that causes prices to go up. If prices don't go up, you don't have a monopoly. That was Bork's simple explanation. And it kind of goes back to my simple explanation of what a monopoly is. A monopoly is something that destroys competition. Well, the principal function of competition is to keep prices down. So there was some sort of rational logic to what Bork was saying. It just was BS. It just didn't work. But Bork was successful in getting the Reagan administration to adopt this as policy. Reagan basically stopped enforcing the antitrust laws in 82, and no president has started since then. And he got the federal court to adopt this as well. In the GTE Sylvania case, the U.S. Supreme Court adopted Bork's logic. And as a result of that, every major industrial sector, every major business sector in America now is basically a monopoly. It's controlled by 3 to 5 companies who control more than 70 to 80% of the entire sector, whether it's pharmaceuticals or hotels or fast food restaurants or clothing retailing or car manufacturing, airlines. Pick your poison. And as a result of that, the average family in America is paying an additional $5,000 a year in what I call a monopoly tax. Prices actually have gone up, but Bork's damage has been done, and nobody's even looking at enforcement through his lens anymore. But Bork is the singular guy who's probably more responsible than anybody else for the monopolization of business in the United States in the modern sense.
We're speaking with Tom Hartman. The latest in his Hidden History series is The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. Could you talk a little bit more about that monopoly tax that you just mentioned? Why do you say what you just said?
Sure. Well, let me give you an example. In the United States, the federal government has decided that if Comcast, let's use them as an example because they provide internet service to about half of America. If Comcast owns the cable TV line that comes into my house and I'm going to buy internet service over that same piece of copper wire, then Comcast is the only company that I can buy it from as long as I'm getting it off their wire. That's not how it used to be in the United States. In the early days of the internet, whatever phone company you had would provide you, could provide you with access to internet service with a modem on your phone. But you could pick which internet service provider you wanted. You could have CompuServe, you could have AOL. There were thousands of small ones all over the country throughout the 90s and the early 2000s. And it's still that way in Europe. They mandate competition among internet service providers in Europe. But here in the United States, the FCC changed the rules so that Comcast can say to me, no, you have to buy your internet service from us or nobody else, period. We won't let anybody else provide you with internet service over our copper. Whereas in Europe, an internet service provider, if I wanted to buy my internet from Earthlink instead of from Comcast, if we were Europe, Earthlink would be paying Comcast $1 a month or whatever the actual cost is to get that through their copper, and it would be added to my bill. But basically, I'd be able to buy my internet services from anybody I wanted. And as a result of that, the average American is paying $60 to $100 a month for internet services, depending on where they are, for pretty crappy internet service. Low speeds, bad service, lots of outages. Whereas in Europe, you've got 1 gig up and down, very high speeds, and the average cost is anywhere from $15 or $20 a month on the low end to around $30, $35 a month on the high end. And for the $30, $35 a month charges, in France, for example, you also get cell phone service and cable TV. So this is the $5,000 a year that every one of us is paying extra. We pay literally twice as much for pharmaceuticals as any other developed country in the world, 100% more. If we paid 10 bucks for a drug, that drug is $5 in Canada or any European country. We pay more for hospitalization. We pay almost twice as much for hospitalization as any other country in the world because our hospitals are now owned by large conglomerates, giant monopolies. I mean, just like airfare, we pay dramatically more for airfare than other countries in the world. That's been the result of Bork's work.
You brought up the healthcare one, and you use the example, the tragic example of insulin. Please talk about insulin in the United States and how people are actually dying and the price increase to the consumer, according to the Bork rule, should produce a confrontation to monopolies, but that's not happening. Explain the situation, please.
Well, A, that's not happening because since 82, we haven't been enforcing our antitrust laws, our anti-monopoly laws. But B, the story's pretty straightforward. Insulin was invented in the late 1800s by two guys who gave up the patent. They sold it for $1 to the University of Toronto because they wanted it to be a public good. People were dying from diabetes and had throughout history. And, you know, here was a solution. And insulin was very, very cheap for a long, long time. And then they started developing ways to tweak insulin a little bit, to tweak the molecule to make it more fast-acting or more slow-acting in the body. And these tweaks allowed them to patent this new form of insulin. And the new forms of insulin pretty much replaced the old ones that were extracted from pig pancreases and things like that, so that the old insulin basically was no longer around. And it was all the new insulin. And then this very predatory guy took over Eli Lilly, which was one of the largest, I think the largest producer of insulin in the United States. And he was like, hey, you know, we've got these guys by the neck. You know, we can jack up the price to whatever we want. And he more than doubled the price of insulin. Insulin had been back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, been like just a few dollars a dose. And he took it up to over $100 a dose. I mean, he was just a real classic predator CEO. And as a result of this, there's no shortage of documented cases of people who are cutting back on their insulin. And now it's even worse now that people have lost their jobs and they've lost their health insurance and they can't afford the insulin. People are literally dying all around us. That guy, by the way, he got a new job recently. His name is Alex Azar. and he's now Donald Trump's cabinet secretary for Health and Human Services. He's the guy in charge of the FDA and all that stuff.
That brings markups. You wrote that between 1955 and the 1980s, the average markup was somewhere around 21%. And by 2016, it was 61%. Briefly explain what markups are and how this can be so.
Yeah, markups exist at every level in the supply chain. If it costs me $10 to make a product as a manufacturer, and I sell it for $11, that's a 10% markup. If I sell it for $11 to a wholesaler, and then the wholesaler sells it for $12 to the retailer, that's a 9% markup. If the retailer then doubles the price, which typically they do, the typical markup these days in retail is around 50%, then, although it depends on the product. In food, it's typically actually around 3 or 4%. Basically, what the markup represents is where the company extracts their cost of doing business and their profit. And so as markups have gone up at all levels in this supply chain and in sector after sector after sector, what we've seen is business, big business, because large and small businesses are largely just hanging on by their fingernails and going out of business in record numbers. But big business is just doing fabulously and has been ever since Reagan stopped enforcing the antitrust laws.
Trump and his Republican promoters keep claiming that during his administration, it was the greatest economy in our lifetimes until COVID-19 upended it. And in fact, Senator Inhofe, who's 85 years old, was quoted saying that just today. I'm not sure to what they are referring, perhaps the stock market, but you write in A Hidden History of Monopolies that GDP growth in the 1950s was 3.8%. In the 60s, it was 4.5%. In the 70s, in spite of oil embargoes, it was 3.2%. In the 80s, that's when Reagan's comes in, it was down to 3.1%. The 90s, 3%. The early 2000s, 1.7%. And in the teens, 2.1%. How do you respond to his assertion that it was the greatest economy of our lifetimes?
Well, Joy, as you know, Abraham Lincoln famously said, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And what you're seeing here, what Trump likes to say is more people voted for me than any candidate in the history of America. Well, that's true because the population is growing. You know, we're 340 million people now. When I was born in 1951, the population of America was just a little over 100 million people. Every year we add people. And so every year things are bigger. Doesn't necessarily mean they're better, but more people vote in every election. It happens year after year after year. More people are employed every year, with the exception of major recessions and depressions. More people have higher pay year after year after year. So basically, these claims that Trump has been making that more people voted for me and more people were employed and wages are higher, those are claims that literally every president, with the exception of Herbert Hoover, has been able to make for the last 100 plus years. And presidents throughout the late 1800s could make the same claims. You know, Lincoln couldn't have. But outside of giant catastrophic events, every presidency is always going to be presiding over a larger economy than the previous one because our population continues to grow. It's really that simple.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about the corporate death penalty. That used to actually be a thing. What's going on now? Very briefly, the history of that and the current reality.
I should add to your last question that the economy actually sucks right now. And for working people, it has throughout the 40 years of this failed experiment of Reaganomics, even though more people are working, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sorry, your last question.
Well, the corporate death penalty.
Oh, the corporate death penalty.
In charters, historically, there was the death penalty, but you don't hear so much about that anymore.
Yeah, this was something that went away with the charter mongering era in the 1890s. Prior to the 1890s, every state required that a corporate charter's first sentence say some variation on, this corporation is chartered to serve the people of the state of Michigan, you know, or whatever state it's being incorporated in. and then it would continue through the production of railroad cars or through building houses or whatever the corporation is designed to do. And every Secretary of State was required every year or every 2 years, depending on the state, to examine the books of every corporation in the state and determine if they actually were behaving in the public interest. And if they weren't, corporations were routinely shut down. They were given the death penalty. They were dissolved. Their assets were distributed or sold, distributed to their stockholders or sold in the marketplace. And the money was given to their stockholders and or taken by the state, depending on how egregious the behavior was. And that was the end of that. It happened a couple thousand times a year right up until the 1890s. But basically, since the beginning of the 20th century, we have not been passing out the corporate death penalty. And frankly, I think we need to bring it back.
So that differed from bankruptcy in that it was an issue of malfeasance or not fulfilling the charter. Am I right about that?
Well, yeah, I think the largest distinction is that it was forced by the state rather than allowed or facilitated through the state. But the decision was, you know, a normal bankruptcy, the corporate directors decide that they're going to seek a particular type of bankruptcy, whether it's full out or whether it's reorganization, Chapter 7 or Chapter 11. With the corporate death penalty, the state simply comes in and says, that's it, you're done. And they don't even use the word bankrupt. They just dissolve the company.
You also include in your book on monopolies the work of Wilkinson and Pickett and their Equality Trust. We actually interviewed them back in 2013 when their book Spirit Level came out. Would you remind our listeners about their work and the effects of inequality on a society?
Sure. You're talking about Robert Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. They're a couple of researchers in the United Kingdom who have started an organization called the Equality Trust. I think it's equalitytrust.co.uk or .org.uk, or maybe it's just .org. But in any case, as you said, they wrote this book called The Spirit Level. They have a new book out in the last year called The Inner Level, which updates all their research. And what they found was that the more unequal a society becomes, and this is not about poverty, this is not about how many people are in poverty and the ravages of poverty. This is completely separate from that. That the more unequal a society is, and that can be done entirely by having the very top elevate itself, the more unequal a society becomes, the more a whole series of social ills emerge, from teenage pregnancy and STDs to drug addiction to suicide to homicide to violent crime, to lack of trust in institutions, to increased levels of domestic violence and divorce. The list just goes on and on. And you know this well, Joy, because you've talked with them and read their book. If you wanted to design a political and economic system that had as its primary goal creating inequality, you would do basically two things. You would, number one, legalize the bribery of politicians. And that's what the Supreme Court did in 1976 and 1978 with the Buckley and Bilotti decisions, and then hyper-ratified with Citizens United, number one. And number two, you would do away with the laws that act as basically capitalism's immune system that prevent oligarchies or monopolies from arising and freezing out competition. And so now we are the most unequal of all the advanced countries in the world by a long shot. And we also have all those social ills in ways that basically no other developed country has. The closest to us is the United Kingdom, because with Margaret Thatcher in the late 70s and then Ronald Reagan in 1980, we both started pursuing the same neoliberal, hyper-conservative austerity course. And both countries have largely stayed on that. The rest of the world has not dabbled so much with Reaganism and Thatcherism, and they're much better off for it.
Speaking of those Supreme Court decisions that revolved around the idea that corporations are persons, did I understand correctly that you were the one who uncovered the origins of that in some clerk's memo about a 19th century court decision?
There was actually a guy whose first name is Jay, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his last name right now, but I reference him in my book, in the first book I wrote on this topic, Unequal Protection, who back in 1954, in an obscure law journal, wrote an article about that case, pointing out that in 1886, The Supreme Court did not rule that corporations are persons. In fact, that decision ruled the opposite, and that he thought there was something hinky going on there. And so I tracked down, went into the Library of Congress, the National Archives, and looked at the actual files of Chief Justice Morrison Remick Waite, 1886, and Justice Stephen Field, who brought these tax cases from California to the Supreme Court, arguing that corporations should be considered persons under the Constitution and therefore have constitutional rights like privacy, the right not to incriminate yourself, the right of free speech, etc. And he lost the case, but the clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, wrote this headnote, which has no legal standing, saying that Waite had said that they had granted corporations personhood, which Waite had never done. Waite protested, but within a year, Waite was dead. He was very sick from heart failure, heart disease, even at the time of the decision. And so that's been, you know, we've been singing to that tune ever since.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Tom Hartman, thank you again for joining us on Forthright Radio and for continuing with the Hidden History series with this latest one, Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. We very much appreciate your work.
Thank you, Joy. Thanks so much for having me on. And just FYI, the next one is going to be on oligarchy and tyranny and tracing the rise of Trump and all kinds of other stuff. And that is available for pre-order also in bookstores now.
When do you expect that to be out?
It'll be out in the spring, February, March.
Well, we'll have to have you back then.
I look forward to it.
I always learn so much from these books. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joy.
You have just heard an interview with author and radio host Tom Hartman about the latest in his Hidden History series, The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream, which has just been released by Barrett Kohler Publishing. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.